In 1601, a group of English merchants pooled their resources for a risky venture to the East Indies. When their ships returned laden with pepper, investors celebrated a staggering 95% profit. Three expeditions later, their vessels lay wrecked at the bottom of the ocean, and fortunes vanished overnight. This pattern of spectacular wins and devastating losses wasn't a bug in early capitalism. It was the feature that would reshape the world. What began as merchant adventurers exploiting price differences between distant markets evolved into something far more transformative. These early capitalists weren't just trading goods, they were pioneering a revolutionary idea, investing money with the expectation of profit. The English and Dutch East India Companies developed joint stock structures to spread risk, and by 1688, their shares traded actively on the London Stock Exchange. Amsterdam merchants built warehouses large enough to hold grain for the entire country for over a decade, not to prevent famine, but to control prices through artificial scarcity. But merchant capitalism was merely the prologue. Industrial capitalism fundamentally transformed human existence itself. Consider James McConnell and John Kennedy, two Scottish entrepreneurs who started with 1770 in 1795 and built a cotton empire employing 1,500 workers by the 1830s. Their success rested on a brutal equation. Profit came from exploiting labor. Children as young as 7 worked 13.5-hour days in their mills. As automation advanced, skilled workers found themselves replaced by cheaper hands. Work became sharply separated from life, creating leisure time as a distinct concept that workers fought desperately to expand. Capitalism simultaneously commercialized this hard-won leisure, developing entire industries around rail excursions and spectator sports. The system that created free time also figured out how to profit from it. Why did capitalism emerge in Europe rather than China, India, or the Islamic world? The answer lies in fragmentation and competition, not European superiority. By the 16th century, Britain's economy thrived on small-scale manufacturing, textiles, metalware, household items. Over half of households depended partly on wage labor, creating a substantial consumer class. A national market centered in London connected regional trade through fairs, markets, and traveling merchants. The putting-out system represented a crucial evolutionary step. Merchants distributed raw materials to rural households for processing. While workers owned their tools, merchants gradually controlled production processes and quality standards. Britain's transformation stemmed from changing rural relationships. Market relationships replaced feudal ones as lords became commercial landlords collecting rent from competing tenant farmers. The enclosure movement transformed common land into private property, creating both a land market and wage-dependent labor force, often brutally disrupting traditional communities. Europe's multi-state political structure proved crucial. Unlike civilizations dominated by single empires, fragmentation allowed economic development without bureaucratic constraints. Entrepreneurs could relocate when conditions deteriorated, explaining capitalism's shifting centers from Italian city-states to the Low Countries to England. Competition between states drove innovation as rulers sought strength through economic development. Paradoxically, feudalism itself contained capitalism's seeds. Its complex obligations created conditions where markets and wage labor could emerge. Capitalism has evolved through three distinct stages, each marking fundamental shifts in economic organization and social relations. Anarchic capitalism emerged during Britain's Industrial Revolution. Small factories competed fiercely with minimal oversight, creating notorious working conditions. Workers organized early trade unions despite employer hostility. The state began regulating factory conditions from 1802, while paradoxically dismantling traditional regulations governing apprenticeships, wages, and food prices by 1815. Managed capitalism emerged in the late 19th century and peaked in the 1970s, characterized by declining competition and increasing regulation. Employers consolidated through mergers, creating giants like Imperial Tobacco and Unilever. The state transformed from repressing workers to managing discontent, extending voting rights, protecting unions legislatively, and expanding welfare through the 1911 National Insurance Act and the post-war welfare state. Remarketist capitalism emerged as managed capitalism collapsed under international competition in the 1970s. Thatcher's neoliberal policies abandoned Keynesianism, prioritized inflation control over employment, and excluded unions from policymaking. Market forces were revived through welfare cuts, privatization, and the 1986 financial Big Bang. Ironically, this free market required extensive state intervention, new regulatory offices, unprecedented union restrictions, and tight central control over local authorities. The result offers greater consumer choice, but significantly less security, intensified work pressures, and substantially greater inequality. Despite neoliberal pressures since the 1970s, Swedish, American, and Japanese capitalism reveal persistent differences that challenge convergence theories. Swedish capitalism built strong labor movements through export competitiveness. Social Democrats, 1932 to 1976, created extensive welfare and wage solidarity policies, compressing wage differentials. Though the Swedish model declined from its 1960s-70s peak, 81% union membership in 2003 shows collectivist structures coexisting with economic growth. American capitalism embraced individualism, yet required state intervention to regulate monopolies. The New Deal introduced relief programs and pro-labor legislation. However, the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act weakened unions, creating distinctly more individualistic capitalism than European counterparts. Japanese capitalism features reconstructed zaibatsu, business groups coordinating across industries while competing intensely. Mutual ownership freed them from dividend pressures, enabling long-term strategies and lifetime employment. Despite liberalization, including Renault's Nissan takeover, Japan maintains below OECD unemployment and persistent marketization resistance. All three systems moved similarly, yet remain distinct. Different organizational structures survive remarketization while compatible with market mechanisms, proving societies retain meaningful choices about organizing economic life within capitalism's constraints. Global capitalism captures modern realities: massive cross-border money transfers, multinational manufacturing, and global markets, but perpetuates myths worth examining. The first myth: global capitalism is new. Capitalism went global almost immediately, with merchant capitalists following 15th and 16th century navigators to establish intercontinental trade. The 19th century communications revolution, steam power and telegraph, transformed commerce by enabling mass movement of goods and slashing communication times. Capitalist production has doubled the world proletariat to 3 billion in 30 years. Transnational corporations grew from 7,000 in 1973 to 26,000 in 1993. Mexico's maquiladoras, border plants employing cheap, mostly female labor, exemplify this expansion. Information technology now enables office work transfer abroad, with India becoming a software hub. Despite globalization rhetoric, capitalist activity remains concentrated. Most money flows between North America, Europe, and Japan. Emerging markets hold only 7% of world capital, despite containing 85% of the global population. International wealth disparities have exploded. In 1820, the five richest countries were three times wealthier than the five poorest. By 1992, 72 times wealthier. Capitalism has truly gone global in one respect: eliminating alternatives. The 1989 collapse of state socialism removed the main rival economic model. While capitalism is now the only viable system globally, alternatives exist within capitalism, if not to it. In 17th century Amsterdam, tulip bulbs became objects of frenzied speculation through promissory notes. When prices reached unsustainable levels, the market collapsed. There was no real demand for the ordinary tulips drawn into speculation. Crises in capitalism aren't exceptional events, but normal functions. Production became separated from consumption. Goods were produced for speculative market sale rather than immediate use. Competition drove producers to expand production, leading to overproduction when supply exceeded demand. This triggered falling prices, reduced investment, worker layoffs, and further decreased consumer demand, creating vicious cycles. After the 1970s, growth rates halved and crises became frequent. Intensified competition drove companies to seek cheaper labor worldwide, while the Soviet collapse and China's entry brought vast new workforces into the capitalist economy. Yet global demand failed to match increasing production capacity. Capital increasingly shifted from production to speculation in shares, currencies, and derivatives, creating new instability. The information technology revolution promised escape through new growth, yet capitalism's boom-bust cycle persisted. Crises are normal features of capitalism. The post-1945 quarter century of stable growth wasn't historically typical. Without viable alternatives, capitalism's dominance appears secure. Even China and Vietnam have embraced market mechanisms. The system produces tremendous wealth alongside growing inequality, integrating billions into global markets while concentrating benefits among elites. The 2008 financial crisis exposed capitalism's inherent instability and continuing dependence on state intervention. Climate change demands massive reorientation, pricing carbon, transitioning to renewables, rethinking growth-based models. Digital technologies transform work, potentially eliminating traditional jobs while creating new ones. China's state-directed capitalism challenges Western assumptions linking free markets with democracy. Reform requires engaging capitalism's internal possibilities rather than protesting from outside. National varieties, Nordic social democracy, East Asian developmental states, Anglo-American liberalism, demonstrate significant societal choice exists within capitalism's framework. The 21st century challenge isn't overthrowing capitalism, but reshaping it toward environmental sustainability, social justice, and meaningful work. By recognizing capitalism as historical creation rather than natural system, we see its future remains open to human choice and political action. The question isn't whether capitalism continues, but what form it takes and whose interests it serves.